everybody. My name is Lydia, and I'm an alcoholic. Hi. My sobriety date is May 9th, 1998, and I have a home group and a sponsor, and I sponsor women in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I wasn't nervous until we pulled up in the parking lot outside, and I suddenly was like, oh my God, I can't remember my story. And but like I was saying to some people before the meeting started, if there's one thing I know how to talk about, it's me. And I am my own favorite subject, and I'm sure I have something to say about me and my relationship to alcohol. And I was thinking also that something that's very comforting to me when I get nervous about sharing is that I'm nervous because I have great respect for this program, and also I have great respect for what alcohol has done in my life, you know, and alcohol was devastating, and Alcoholics Anonymous has really totally transformed me. You know, I'm not the same person that I was almost 13 years ago when I came into these rooms, and also, you know, the most basic thing that I'm asked to do here is to share with another alcoholic my experience. You know, what it was like for me when I was out there, what happened to me to bring me in here, and what I'm like today. And so I'm going to do the best that I can to be rigorously honest with you about the truth about me. And I took my first drink of alcohol, well, that I can remember, at the age of 8. And it was all very glamorous. In my mind, anyway, at the age of 8, my dad was a professor for a renowned university, and we were living in Florence, Italy at the time. And in Italy, the culture is very different than ours, and it's not a big deal for a small child to have a glass of red wine or something like that. You know, just a little bit, not anything too much. But there were a lot of college students around, and I remember one night, you know, I was enjoying some wine, and I came up with this philosophy with the college students, you know, that red wine was being served all wrong. That wouldn't it be better if it were chilled, you know? And you know, the sages of the ages or whatever, and all the winemakers that had it wrong, that white wine would be better if it was served at room temperature, and red wine would be better if it was served chilled. And that didn't seem odd to me at all until I was probably about 4 or 5 years sober. I looked back on that and I thought, that's a strange relationship for an 8-year-old to have with wine, you know, to be even contemplating it at all. And of course, I didn't become a daily drinker or anything at the age of 8, but the, like Clancy describes, the great love affair had begun, you know. I remember that drink, you know. I don't think I'll ever forget it because it instantaneously changed the entire world around me, you know. All of a sudden, I felt like I had never felt before, you know, worthy of being there, like comfortable in my own skin. And I always felt like that, even on the playground, you know, like I just didn't know what I was doing wrong. People didn't seem to react the same way to me that they did to others. And you know, by the time I was 15 or 16 years old, and my father's an alcoholic, and I can say that with a surety because he's over 9 years sober today in Alcoholics Anonymous. But by the time I was 15 or 16 years old, I figured out how to effectively steal booze from him without him noticing. And I would do this stuff like where I'd get like an empty water bottle, and I'd pour a little bit of this and a little bit of that in there, and it tasted disgusting. And me and my friends had nicknamed it suicide juice because it really was awful. But I didn't care. That wasn't the point. You know, the point was the effect, you know, the way that alcohol made me feel inside my own skin, you know, and it took all that, you know, teenage angstiness out of it, and suddenly the world was filled with roses, and I was a part of, and I deserved to be in your company, you know. And from that point, you know, I remember being, I was very broody, you know, I loved the dark, you know. At one point, I was like wearing all black, and that was my uniform. All black, Doc Martens, Metallica t-shirt, shaved the back of my head, dark eye makeup, you know, and I never smiled. I thought that was like a sign of weakness. And because I, you know, when I was growing up, I was like a heavier kid, and you know, kids are not the nicest sometimes when you're a little bit different, and you know, so I grew up being made fun of, and this was like the way I figured it out. You know, if I make people afraid of me, they won't hurt me anymore. You know, so at one point, I found like a satanic Bible, and I was carrying it around under my arm. Never read it. It was for the effect. I would carry it around like down the halls of the middle school, you know, like 6th, 7th grade. I'd carry around the satanic Bible because people would be like, they just see me coming and they, you know, try and get on the other side of the hall before I crossed their paths. And I enjoyed that. It felt like I had a little bit of power, you know, but of course, I've always been a pacifist. I've never hit anybody in my life, you know, and I never would. It was all about the image, you know, and right about that time is when my drinking really took off, and I couldn't wait to get to high school because I knew there would be drugs there. And it was, you know, it's amazing to me, spiritual likes attract. Within, like, my first couple of months of ninth grade at high school, I had fallen in with that crowd, you know, and I was skipping school, all the stuff that had been important to me previous to that, like, I had been on 3 soccer teams at one time, we were so good that we even got to travel back to Italy in order to play, and with some other teams, and I was a very good flute player. I had been asked to do like solos in every band I'd ever been in, and I loved playing flute. And there was a lot of other stuff like that, you know, things that I felt cultivated this little spirit that I had, you know. And when alcohol came into the picture, none of that seemed that important anymore. You know, all of a sudden, well, I quit playing soccer because I knew I was going to have to quit smoking cigarettes, and I didn't want to do that. Smoking cigarettes just seemed really, really cool, and I didn't want to have to give them up. And I had to quit playing flute because everybody told me that I was dorky. So I couldn't do that. I couldn't let other people know that I did that. And so on and so on and so on, until all that was left was hanging out with these people, skipping school, stealing from convenience stores, stealing from my mom's wallet, making up lies, seeing who I could get into my circle so that I could manipulate them out of whatever it was that I thought they had that I needed. And by the end of, I did somehow manage to graduate the ninth grade. But when I began the 10th grade year, I just couldn't show up. My first class of the day was phys ed, which I hated because they made you dress up in those little uniforms, you know. So it became like my mission to really make it as hard as possible for the physical education teacher. So every day I was like having a mini protest of one, where I'd like sit in the corner and tell her all the reasons why it was degrading and, you know, they were offensive to me, you know. So I was always in the principal's office. And very, very quickly, I just stopped going. I had some friends of mine lived just down the street, so I would take the bus to school, and I would just walk right on over to my friend's house, and we'd drink all day. And it was, you know, 16, 17 years old, I couldn't afford to buy what I really wanted, which was Jack Daniels. So I just drank whatever was there. You know, I smoked whatever was there. I did whatever was there. And, you know, like Wild Irish Rose and Mad Dog 2020. something called Pop-Off Vodka. I remember that being really hilarious. It was like lighter fluid. Yeah. And it came in like a huge, like, 3-gallon jug or something. You could barely even lift it to pour it. But I knew almost right away that there was something wrong with me. But I thought I must be insane. I remember being in that one of those ninth grade classes when I actually still used to show up, and we were in PE class, and every once in a while it would become health class, and we were reading through a textbook, and it talked about addiction and alcoholism, and it described an alcoholic as being typically male. Manifests in people 40 or older, and said a number of other things, you know. And I instantly said, well, that's not me. You know, I don't have to worry about that. And, you know, at the time, it was like MTV ruled my world, so I thought, you know, heroin chic was really in, and I thought, well, I'm a drug addict. That's what I want to be. And wanting to be a drug addict is not sane. not a normal reaction to life. That's what I've come to learn in AA anyway. You guys have told me that's not a sane reaction to life. But, you know, even back then, I wanted it. I coveted that kind of life. You know, there was something very exciting about it. And I knew the magic that occurred when me and other substances came together. It was just something magical, you know, like the worlds colliding in some sort of way that could never be reproduced otherwise. And I remember I was very suicidal almost from the beginning. You know, I started dating this guy who looked older than he was, and we had fake IDs, but it was nobody ever believed my fake ID because I looked like I was 12, you know. But he would get away with it. He looked older than he was, and so he could get alcohol. And he every time we got drunk together, things got violent, you know. And I stayed with him for three or four years, and every time we got drunk, things got violent. But I used it, you know. I wasn't able to see this for a long time in my sobriety, but there's a lot of my own inventory in that, you know, that I loved being the victim. I loved it being someone else's fault, the way that I was drinking and the way that I had to defend myself against this horrible front, which was the world and life, you know. And I think that's why ultimately I kept myself in that relationship for so long, is because it was just such a great excuse, you know. Don't you guys see? This is why I have to get drunk. You know, you would too if you were in my position. And eventually what ended up happening was he was a little bit older than me, and he went away to college. And I was like, thank God, you know, because that was the only way I was ever going to get away from him, is if he left me, you know. I had no self-esteem. I had no self-worth. I thought I was just the biggest piece of trash on the face of the planet. And no one would ever love me, you know. No one except someone like that would ever be able to love me. And I had very dark, very, very dark moments where I'd, you know, be drinking alone in my room and wishing that I had the courage to kill myself, you know. And I had many, many attempts, you know, where it's hard to say how many of them were serious and how many of them were just attention-seeking or just, you know, trying to do something to make myself feel like I had control, you know. But I would take entire bottles of sleeping pills and then wake up very refreshed about 18 hours later. And I would drink myself to that place of passing out or blacking out, you know. And the horror, because my mind wouldn't shut off, you know. So I'd be right at that point where I couldn't keep my head up anymore, and I knew I was like just about to pass out, and I would be overcome by terror that I would pass out and then I would die, you know. I was so drunk that I would just stop breathing, and I'd be trying to keep myself awake, and I just couldn't fight it, you know. That's what it was like almost every time I drank the last year of my drinking. And I discovered that through my experience, I discovered that I was very powerless. After that abusive relationship ended, I immediately started another one. a friend of mine that I drank with very closely. We grew up in the same town. We went to the same school. He was selling crack and drinking every day, and he stole his parents' car, ended up in D.C. with a collapsed lung. And he went before the judge, and the judge said, rehab or jail. And he chose rehab wisely. So they put him in Arlington County detox, and I was one of the only people in his life that showed up to visit him there. And he started telling me about the meetings that they were taking him to. And I don't know if it was a real thought or if it was just a feeling, but I got the sense that he and I drank very similarly, and he was in big trouble, and he was calling himself an alcoholic. He asked me if I wanted to go to a meeting with him, and I thought, well, I don't want to lose this almost the only person left in my life who's willing to hang out with me and drink with me like I want to drink. So maybe I'll go with him to an AA meeting. And when he got out of there, I went with him to an AA meeting, and thus began my relationship with 24-hour chips, which lasted a long time. But I was going, you know, I found like a young people's group in Fairfax, Virginia that I liked, and I liked it because people hung out in the parking lot for the entire meeting and didn't go in, and it was, you know, it was like a fashion show. Everybody would, like, put on their best and, you know, come and parade for one another, and I just thought it was fun, you know. I never had the opportunity to be my age, you know. I was always trying to be older than I was or thinking about things I shouldn't, you know, a normal child wouldn't have to think about. And I felt like for the first time that, like, maybe I could just be a teenager, you know. I was 19 years old. And so I started trying to go to this meeting, and my friend would take me out to some other meetings, you know, which were also very good, and I would listen to the stories, and I would just think, wow, you know, wow, that's intense, you know, what's going on with you? It's intense. And I don't know if I related a lot, because I couldn't really hear, you know, my brain was very, very foggy, and I didn't seem to have the ability to connect my experience with other people's experiences. I also couldn't read at the time. I wasn't illiterate. I had learned to read in school, but I literally could not focus my mind in on something long enough to understand what it was saying to me. So I would read the same sentence over and over and over again, and I never got a big book during that period, but someone had handed me like a little pamphlet that sort of went through a short form of each of the steps, and I tried so hard to read it, you know, because I wanted to know. People were asking me, you know, do you have a sponsor? Do you have a sobriety date? Do you have a home group? Do you have service positions? You know, have you been through the steps? And I was just, no, 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 no. You know, I don't even know what the steps are. Like, somebody gave this to me. I couldn't comprehend it, you know. And eventually, other things became more important. You know, the couple of meetings a week that I was going to turned into one meeting a week, and we started playing a lot more laser tag and hanging out in the middle of the night smoking cigarettes and, you know, doing bad things in dark parks and, you know, you know, eventually it got to the point where it had been a month since I'd been to an AA meeting, and I felt that swirliness come back up in me. And I could tell that alcohol had really been devastating in my life, because even just the not drinking part, the physically not putting alcohol or other substances in my body, things had started to get a little bit better, you know. I had this relationship with this guy, and it was like love at first sight, you know, totally love at first sight, a deep connection with another human being. And, you know, I had gotten this nice new car, and my job had, you know, had all the trust in the world in me. I was a supervisor for a convenience store chain and or drugstore chain. Drugstore chain. and they really liked what I did, because I had to keep up the image. It was always about the double life. I couldn't let other people know what was really going on inside of me. I didn't want my family to know, and I didn't want most of my friends to know either, you know. And so I always showed up. If they told me to be there at 7 a.m., even if I had been out drinking until 3 o'clock that morning, I showed up at 7 a.m. ready to work, you know. And so they loved me there, and I could see clearly that not drinking was a good idea in my life, that if I wanted good things to happen for me, not drinking would probably be the way to go. But I got to that place, you know, where I didn't see the point in continuing to go to the meeting, the one meeting that I was going to. And time slipped by, and before I knew it, that friend of mine who had gone to rehab, my parents were out of town. They were gone for 6 weeks. I was the person taking care of the home while they were gone, and, you know, position of trust. They trusted me, and he said he was coming over, and I said, why don't you pick up some booze on your way? And he said, okay, and hung up the phone before I could say, wait, I thought about it. And then he came over with a big bag of, like, whatever he could manage to collect, you know. And and I remember that moment, you know, and it sends chills through me just thinking about it. But I remember him standing in my kitchen and opening a 40 and starting to drink it. And I said, it was like in that moment I thought, if you drink this, you're going to lose everything that you've just gained by this almost a year of sobriety I had, something like 10 or 11 months. And and then I put the bottle to my lips and I said, fuck it, you know. I remember that being a very distinct thought, and it was like the light switch just went off, you know. Everything in my mind instantly changed, instantly. It wasn't a process. It didn't take me weeks to go back to the same way that I used to think. I instantly started thinking the same way that I had been 11 months previously, you know, previous to that. I thought that was a big waste of time. All these opportunities to get really good and drunk I missed out on, all these great parties, all these, you know, all these experiences that I didn't have because I wasn't drinking. You know, and I was back out there drinking for 3 months, and that's how long it took for me to really just get dragged through the worst bits of hell I've ever experienced in my life. And every single day I woke up, I wish I hadn't. I felt physically horrible. I couldn't make connections with people. My parents were suspicious. My job became suspicious. I was trying as best that I could to keep up this double life, but I would do things like get in the car and just start driving, and I would say, I'm never coming back, you know, and I would get as far as, like, where 66 becomes 81, and I would turn around and come back, because I realized I don't have any money, I don't have anywhere to go, and I felt so trapped, you know, like, completely trapped. I had nowhere to go, and a friend of mine, we had gone down to a bar in D.C., and they didn't card us. You know, I was only 20 years old. They didn't card us. And I was like, wow, this has opened up a whole new world to me, bars that don't card. And so I started showing up there on a regular basis. And before I knew it, I was so drunk, I was selling my body on the streets of Washington, D.C. And there's no reason why I should still be alive today to tell you that. I don't know why I'm getting emotional, but thank you to whoever puts these back here. you know, and it took me a long time to connect that behavior with my alcoholism. You know, that's how dirty and disgusting I felt about myself, that it didn't even matter. This body didn't matter, that I needed to do something to make my outsides match my insides, you know? And so I did horrible, degrading things, usually in a blackout, thank God, you know? And some of those memories have bubbled to the surface, and some of them haven't, and that's just fine with me. But I know what I'm capable of today. I'm not a nice girl that drank too much. I'm really not. I'm like the big book describes, I'm the real alcoholic. I'm a real alcoholic, you know? And it'll literally take me through the gates of insanity and death. And that's not a theory to me today. That's the absolute truth. And so what ended up happening was 3 months of this, and I just wanted to die. And my friend who had taken me to AA the first time, he had also been drinking, and he said, I really want to go back to AA. I'd like to go to a meeting tonight. And he'd come over to my house, and he was like, the meeting's downtown in D.C., and I was like, oh, no, I'm not driving you down there. I'm not driving you to D.C. And he's like, well, okay, then I'm going to have to leave now because I'm going to have to take the metro and then the bus and then walk. And I was like, all right, I'll take you down there. So being by myself, oh, my God, please, God, don't leave me alone. I cannot stand being by myself. And so I took him to this AA meeting, and it ended up being my home group, the meeting that became my home group. And that night, I don't know how they knew I was new. But all these women surrounded me. At the end of the meeting, they just surrounded me. They were asking me all these weird questions, you know, like, when was the last time you drank? How are you? You know, and I'd just look at the floor. I just couldn't do it. I couldn't look you in the eye. I didn't know what the proper response was when somebody asked me a question like, how are you? I just would start giggling and look at the floor because I was terrified. I was absolutely terrified of you, you know. And especially, you know, these women that I had met, they were nicely dressed, and they had bright, clear eyes, and they looked me dead in them, you know, and they seemed genuinely interested in me, and I just knew they could see right through me. They could see me right through to my dark, like, broken, rotten soul. And this one woman came up to me, and she was wearing, like, paint-spattered overalls, and I was like, finally, you know, like, a woman who's not dressed like a Barbie. And that's what I thought. I did not feel how those women looked, you know. I felt like something a truck had run over and then backed up over and then run over again and dragged around for a while. And I probably smelled, and I, you know, all those glorious things that we come in here with. And I thought I was appropriately dressed when I wasn't. And And she came up to me and she said, she just did asked the same question. She's like, have you been sober long? You have a sponsor? How, you know, are you okay? And I just said to her, will you be my sponsor? Because she was wearing overalls. The only reason, you know, she was wearing overalls and she seemed nice. And she said, it's okay. and she said that she would. And then I asked her, how do you do this? You know, the group, my home group at that time was about 150 people. It was a speakers meeting. And I asked her, how do you do this? You know, all these people. And she said, you just find a couple of people and you stick yourself in their back pocket. And I'll never forget that. You know, best piece of advice I've ever been given. And so that's what I set about to do. And it wasn't long before the defiance and the self-righteousness began to set in. I'd done this before and it didn't work. You know, what are you giving me, homework? I got to read something. I got to write something. You know, she gave me the deal. She told me, I showed up at her house one day that week, and we had dinner together, and we went through the doctor's opinion together, and she told me all the things that she did on a daily basis to stay sober, which included, you know, she woke up in the morning, and she said her prayers, and she read her meditation book, and she showed up dressed and prepared for a day's work, and then she came home, and she had dinner with people in Alcoholics Anonymous, and then she drove, and she picked people up for the meeting, showed up for the meeting, did her service position, came home. If she had step work to do, she did that. She kept in contact with her family. She'd made amends. You know, she said her prayers, and she went to bed at a reasonable hour. And I was like, wow, I'm not doing that. Like, that's just, you know, that's a lot. I mean, I'm very busy person. I have lots of social engagements to keep up with, and I didn't, you know. What I wanted to do was what I did the last time, where I showed up to meetings occasionally, and I went out and played music with the guys and ended up getting drunk at the end, you know. And but, you know, I knew something was different this time. There's something about her, you know, and I don't know if I was afraid of her, or I trusted her or something, you know, but I just kept doing what she told me to do, even though I felt really belligerent about it. On the inside, I was like, hell no, I'm not doing that. And then I would just show up, and now I was doing it. And I would, like, be arguing with myself inside my mind, like, why are you doing this? You said you weren't going to do this. And, like, here I am, you know. And you know, eventually, you know, I got it, you know, even though I felt differently than what I was doing was AA. You know, showing up to meetings regularly, I got in a service position, I was talking to my sponsor on a daily basis, she'd started me on the steps, I'd done a fourth step and a fifth step, and I had begun to contemplate my victimhood and the real truth about that, you know, just a little peek into the truth about me not being a victim, and so I was doing all this stuff, yet I still felt like I didn't want to be there. You know, I felt like I'm 20 years old and I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. It hadn't really sunk into me yet that what I was an alcoholic of the hopeless variety, and that if I, you know, didn't do Alcoholics Anonymous, I would probably end up dead. And that had to happen in sobriety. You know, I had to hit a bottom, an emotional bottom, sober. And how I did that was by doing a lot of lying. I gotten this job. I gotten this other job where I, you know, sometimes was asked to work at night, and I took that and I ran with it. You know, sort of lying, called it blockbuster sobriety at the time, where I'd tell my sponsor that I had to work late, but really I'd just go get a movie and stay at home and watch it. You know, and I don't even know if it was a couple of months. It may have really been only a couple of weeks. I found myself so insane that I was literally standing at a fork in the road. I was either going to go to the women's meeting that was at my sponsor's house that night, or I was going to go home and get good and drunk. And everything in me wanted to go home and get good and drunk, yet my car drove me to the women's meeting. And my sponsor said, seriously, my car just drove on over there. And for some reason, the woman who was sharing, something about it struck me in such a way that the moment she stopped, my hand went up, and for some reason, the truth just came tumbling out of my mouth, probably for the first time in my life, you know, the real truth about me. I told them exactly what I had been doing, and exactly the way that I felt, and when the meeting was over, the woman who had been leading the meeting, she came up to me with a 12 and 12, and she opened it to page 37. You know, if you haven't read that page, it's a really good page. It's one of my favorites, but it talks about, you know, how You people can advise me all you want about alcohol, but when it comes to the rest of the stuff, that's me. That's my business. And how if his image in the mirror is too difficult to bear. You know, I related to that. I could not, you know, I was almost a year sober, and I could not look at myself in the mirror. When I was in the bathroom getting ready, I was always averting my eyes, you know. I couldn't look myself in the eye in the mirror. I certainly couldn't look you in the eye. I was still looking at the ground, you know, barely ever smiling. And years later, my friends told me they thought I was a snob. They thought I was stuck up, you know. They didn't want to talk to me. The truth was, I was absolutely terrified, you know, just so terrified and fearful, you know. And so, I lost my train of thought. I hate it when that happens. Thank you. She pointed to page 37. I related to that so deeply. I mean, I had one of those moments where I thought, how did they know about me to write this in here? And I realized they couldn't have. It was written in 1950, and the man who had written it was dead. There's no way they could literally be speaking specifically about me, yet they knew me, you know. And it was like, you know, the big book describes it, a spiritual experience. I had a spiritual experience that night where I knew deep down to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic and that I'd better do this or things weren't going to be good, you know. And that was all I needed to throw myself in the middle of this, you know. Really, things got really good really fast. Someone offered me a job. Someone in the program offered me this great job. And I had, you know, I had barely finished high school. I wasn't doing college. And I tried to do college when I first got sober. And what ended up happening was I kept driving to the parking lot and telling myself that, my honest thought was, you're nothing but a whore and they're going to see it. And I would drive away. You know, I couldn't do it. I just couldn't. I was so afraid of what I thought other people thought about me, that I just couldn't show up, you know. And so this woman offered me this really amazing job where they completely trained me to do. I was working for this law firm, and I for the first time in my life, I had money, and I could be self-supporting. I moved out. I moved in with sober women who, you know, all of them are still sober today. 11 years later, they're all still sober. One of them just came back, but that's okay. We welcomed her. But I moved in with these sober women, and I started dating the man who would become my first husband. Everything on the outside looked really good. So I did what I was supposed to do. I did service positions. I tried the best that I could to talk to newcomers, although I was not very good with newcomers for a long time. I did my step work. I showed up for work as best I could, and I tried to be a good girlfriend. And then, you know, when he proposed, I tried to be a good fiance, and when we got married, I tried to be a good wife. But what ended up happening was I started to rest on my laurels. You know, the laurels are gifts. You know, I had been given all of these gifts through right living. And I just decided that was enough. You know, I didn't know it then. It wasn't really a conscious thought. But I let my behavior slip. You know, I was one person when I was here with you, and I was another person when I was at home with my husband. You know, and now with the benefit of many years hindsight and a little more spiritual growth, I cannot believe he stayed with me as long as he did. You know, I was actually quite abusive. Every opportunity I got, I told him how I felt was his fault, you know, and I felt like he had gypped me out of a life, you know, that he put this big ring on my finger and made me marry him and come live in this beautiful house and, you know, have two dogs and gorgeous china sets that all matched, and I just couldn't handle it, you know. It was all his fault that he'd done this to me. And, you know, after 3 years of marriage, I had this thought, you know, which was like a moment of clarity, that if I did not take action to do right by him, that I was going to drink, you know. And I wasn't going to drink because it was like the big book talks about it, and more about alcoholism. Sometimes we set out deliberately to get drunk, and we're propelled by certain feelings, you know, like worry, nervousness, jealousy, resentment. And I felt like I was in that place, you know, where like, I'm going to have to go get drunk so that he'll leave me. Because I didn't have the power to do it. You know, I was terrified. I felt like a little girl who was trying to pretend to be an adult, you know, and I had no idea how to do any of it. And I was afraid I wouldn't be taken care of. You know, I had no higher power in my life other than him and these things, these beautiful things that I had and coveted and wanted you to feel jealous that I had, you know. And I had that moment of clarity where I realized I'm going to get drunk over this. And I told myself the truth, which is this is really selfish. This relationship has been very, very selfish for a really long time. The day came where I literally could not stand it one moment longer, and I packed my bags and I left, you know. And that's one of those things where at the time I thought I was doing right, you know. But looking back on it today, you know, I'm trying not to get emotional about it, but looking back on it today, it was awful. You know, he came home from work, I sat him down, and I told him, I don't love you anymore, and I'm leaving. And I literally watched that man's heart break in front of my face. Now, that being said, God took us both to better things almost right away, you know. And I know that it was messy the way that it happened, and the divorce wasn't exactly what I would call friendly or amiable, but we did the best that we could with what we had at the time. And at the end of the day, it was what was best for both of us. And he's married today and he just had a daughter named Emma, and I couldn't be more happy for him. I told Seda on the way up here that I hope they had tissues because I knew I was going to cry. It's a crying kind of day. But it would take many, many more years for me to be able to see the real impact of my choices and my behavior on the lives of the people who dared to care about me. You know, even many years sober, that I was capable of causing such horrible pain and damage in the lives of others, you know. I did my first 8th step and began making amends when I was about a year and a half sober, and I didn't look at that stuff again until I got my current sponsor, Bridget. I didn't look at it again until I was over 10 years sober. So there was a lot of damage that had happened in between there. I just thought, you know, hey, I'm sober now. What do you want from me? And just check the time. Oh, I'm good. Okay. So, you know, I moved out, and I had gone back to college. I was a full-time student. I was living with sober people again, and I literally felt like I did a 4-step with my sponsor about my marriage and my resentments towards him, and really took a look at it. She said to me, "This is the most honest 5th step I've ever heard you give me," you know, because I knew my life was literally on the line. That it was do this or go get drunk, you know. Stop pretending. Just go get drunk. And so I did it. And you know, I had a lot of nights where it was I couldn't sleep or eat for about 3 months. I mean, no sleeping at all. And I lost all this weight, and I was just completely neurotic. But I tried to channel that into force for good. You know, like I literally went to like 3 meetings a day for about 4 months, and my car was just constantly filled with anybody who needed to go to an AA meeting. Come on in, you know, like we'll find room for you. I had a big, huge truck. There were people in the trunk. You know, we're just going to the message. We need the message. Let's go to it. You know, And during that time, you know, a couple of women asked me to sponsor them, and I had been sponsoring a woman since I was about 2 years sober, and she really showed up for me. You know, on days when I couldn't eat, she would come to my house and cook me dinner and make me eat it, you know. And you know, there were a lot of nights where, you know, I lived out in this suburb in Fairfax, and it was really quiet, you know, kind of like it is out here, I would imagine. Like dead quiet, no road noise, nothing, and I couldn't sleep, so it was often I'd find myself 4 o'clock in the morning, totally dead, silent world, no one that I can call, my mind is racing, telling me what a horrible person that I am, and I feel like killing myself, I feel like blowing my brains out, because I can't stand the way that I feel in my own skin. And what do you do? What do you do in moments like that? There's no outside thing that I could possibly turn to make this feel better. You know, and what I did was I turned towards God, you know. And God came in the form of a 4-year-old Boston Terrier named Bodhi. And, you know, this dog literally, I think she literally saved my life. I named her Bodhisattva for a reason. It means enlightened being, you know, because I knew she was connected. I'd heard that somewhere, you know, that like babies and animals had like a closer connection to a higher power. And when I thought about it, I thought, you know, she actually has a perfect third step. She just completely trusts that she's going to be taken care of at all times. That she's going to be loved, she's going to be fed, she's going to be washed, she's going to be cleaned and bathed and snuggled and all those other things that dogs love to do. And so I just decided that if she could be my messenger, that would be really great, you know. And so 4 o'clock in the morning, she'd be sitting on my bed, and, you know, she's really hyperactive dog. And I would say to her, hey, Bodhi, will you pass on a message to God for me? And I swear it was like she knew. She knew what her mission was, and she would just sit up and look at me, you know, yes. And I would tell her, I was like, and at those moments where I was like, okay, I have an audience with God, what do I want to say to him? And I thought, I just want your will, like, please manifest your will in my life. I want you to know that I'm okay, you know, even though this feels horrible right now, I feel okay. I'm okay. I'm going to be okay. And that's where my relationship with God began, you know. And, you know, of course I still pray to the dog today. Every once in a while, I think I see the glint of God coming through her eyes. And but, I, you know, that was the beginning for me. And I just got, I got busy like only the dying can in this program, you know. I loved Alcoholics Anonymous from that point. And I graduated college, and my first husband and I, he had taken me on a honeymoon to Ireland. And when we were in Dublin, we had visited the Trinity College campus, and I remember thinking to myself, what kind of a world would I exist in where a piece of shit like me could come to a great school like this? And I was just finishing up my degree, and I just happened to be fiddling around online, and I saw that Trinity College Dublin had just started this master's program. It's something that I was dearly interested in. And I thought, why not? I'm a free person in a free world. I have no obligations, or I'm not tied down by anything. I might as well just give it a shot. And then the self-centered fear started to creep in, you know. And I was like, well, you're not good enough. You're just going to be rejected, you know. And I called my sponsor, the woman who's my sponsor today. She wasn't my sponsor at the time, but my sponsor was out of town. And I called her, and she was like, why don't you just take the next right action? Just print out the application. You know, and so that's what I did. I took it one teeny little step at a time until I had this packet, this application packet together, and I sent it off, and for some reason they accepted me, you know. And going to Ireland was one of the first deep spiritual experiences that I ever had. As the plane was flying over Ireland and I could see the mist and the clouds start to dissipate from the windows in the airplane, I just felt this feeling inside of me like I was coming home, like my spirit had come to where it had originated. And it was like a dream come true to be able to know that I was going there, and I was going there not to drink, but to, you know, for something good, a good positive purpose. And so I went to Trinity, and I did my degree, and first thing that I did when I got off that plane was I went to an AA meeting, and I raised my hand, and I said, I'm new in town. I'm absolutely terrified. Can I please have a service position, and does anyone need a sponsor? And they made me their tea maker, so I had a service position, and a woman came up to me. She was an expat from New York. She came up to me. She'd been living there like 6 or 7 years. She didn't have a sponsor. She wanted to know if I would sponsor her. You know, so I God provided what I needed. All I had to do was ask. All I had to do was ask, you know? And I didn't feel in the middle yet. The Irish people were very suspicious, and this is part of their culture, you know? So it took me about a year and a half to really build up trust with people there. But once that had happened, I mean, just miracles were happening all around me, you know? And my life was in danger almost every day that I was there. Because Ireland is like no place you've ever been, especially city center Dublin on a Friday or Saturday night. It is literally like you're in an alcoholic circus. And it's all legal, you know. And I lived maybe 2 miles as the crow flies from the Guinness Brewery. I loved Guinness. It was like Mecca. You know, every time I passed it, I was like, I bow down to you. I respect you ultimately. You know, sorry I can't come to visit today, but you know, I'm glad that you're there. But, you know, the truth is that I never thought about it. Unless I passed by it, never occurred to me, you know, that here is Guinness, and that the mental obsession had long been removed, you know. And that didn't need to be the center of my universe, you know, the Guinness Brewery. But I knew that, you know, this was not a safe place for a sober alcoholic. But AA in Dublin is very strong because of that. You know, there are a lot of people who come in with that kind of desperation and willingness, you know, that they've seen their entire family has been beaten down by alcoholism and they don't want to do it anymore, you know. And I met my second husband in an AA meeting, and, you know, he was one of the first, like, young, enthusiastic people that I had met in an AA meeting there, and we quickly became friends, and then, you know, shortly after that, she told me he had feelings for me, and we started dating, and you know, we weren't dating very long before we decided to get married, and we got married in a castle in the Irish countryside, and I felt like a princess, and, you know, I had women that I sponsored were able to make it, and some of my closest, dearest friends from Washington were able to make it over there, and it was like the most perfect day on a cloud on the horizon, you know, and for some reason, right after the wedding was over, all of a sudden, all these women just started asking me to sponsor them, you know, and there were a lot of younger women coming into AA at that time, and in Dublin, which was really rare, you know, really rare. In fact, Ireland tried to ban under-18s from coming into AA meetings because they felt it was a liability, and there just weren't that many of them anyway, right? Except that there were. You know, there were people under the age of 18 dying of alcoholism right under their noses. You know, they just didn't want to see it. They were, like, ruled by fear. So before I knew it, I was sponsoring 10 women, and we were creating the fellowship I so desperately craved. We started having dances. We had, you know, Founders Day events. We did cinema nights, or we went out to the movies, and, you know, anybody who wanted to come, every night after our home group, which was Monday and Thursday nights, we would go down the street to Cafe Moda, where we would have the meeting after the meeting, you know, and anybody who wanted to come, we'd be like, come on, let's just all go down, you know, we'd chain smoke cigarettes, and, like, talk about whatever, you know, and I'm this woman named Geraldine, who actually just celebrated 3 years on the 18th, she came into the meeting one night. It was her first AA meeting ever, and there was a drunk woman sitting next to her. And the drunk woman became belligerent and started throwing vodka on people. And she had raised her hand at the beginning of the meeting and said, you know, this is my first AA meeting. So I instantly, we had to end the meeting early, obviously, because she was being so disruptive. But I ran over to her, and I was like, it's not always like this. You know, it's always still coming back. And she was like, thank God I saw that, because there before the grace of God go I. That is me. That is my future. And she hasn't found it necessary to take a drink ever since, you know, and she's like a kindred spirit, you know. There's no other way to describe it except I felt like I found family in this woman, you know, and I felt that way about almost everybody that I sponsored there. They really enhanced my life. They did way, 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 way more for me than I ever could have possibly imagined doing for them. All I had to do was show up and try the best that I could to be a good example of living the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous in their lives. And they just took me along for the ride, you know. And one woman I sponsored, this woman named Mary, she had just come out of hospital. She had a suicide attempt and still didn't have feeling in her hands or her feet. And we got to work right away. We just come over to my house at this time. We're going to start reading through the book. And I noticed after, like, the third or fourth session that we had had together that she didn't seem to be able to focus in on the page. And I started to wonder, is she using? You know, is she drinking or using? And I had actually, she was supposed to be at my house at 3 o'clock on a Sunday afternoon, and she didn't show up. And I got a phone call from her best friend. She'd been found hanging from a tree in her backyard, and she'd been there for 3 days. And that's the power of alcoholism. You know, the world is literally her oyster. She was young. She was beautiful. She was educated. She came from money. She was just starting to get the program again, and she couldn't take it. She could not take it. And we got a bunch of people together, a bunch of AA people together. We put them in the car. We went to the funeral. And that day, the skies opened up, and it rained like I have never seen rain before. Literally like you're standing under a shower, you know, and I thought, yeah, because Mary was a bit of a rascal, you know, that this is the way she wanted. She wanted us to all get soaked to the bone. She didn't want it to be easy for us, you know, to come and grieve her. There was a huge church service, and I tell you, there were hundreds of people there, hundreds of people. Everybody she'd ever met in AA showed up that day. And And, you know, we got back into the car, and we were, like, contemplating whether or not we would go off to the gravesite, you know, for the last part of the funeral. And Geraldine said to me, "No, Lydia, we're going. We walked the last mile. We're going to..." Sorry. She said, "We're going to walk the last mile, because that's what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and I'll never forget that. I'll never forget that she said that to me. Because that's what we do. We show up, even when it's breaking your heart, we show up, and we walk through these things together, you know. And since that day, I've been to weddings, I've been to funerals, I've seen babies being born, you know. I've got to celebrate, you know, engagements and new jobs and new homes. And, you know, I get to show up for people in their lives, you know, and I know I've only got a couple of minutes left. I wanted to tell you where I'm at today, you know, and I continue to be absolutely in awe and humbled by the power of alcoholism, the devastating and destructive effects that it has on the lives of anyone who dares to care about the sufferer, you know, and my husband and I, we just celebrated our third wedding anniversary. And we visited Ireland. We went home for a trip the first time since we had moved back here together. And while we were there, he had a huge breakdown and got violent, and I had to get on a plane and come back, you know. And when I got back, he asked me to move out of my apartment, you know, and I knew, you know, I knew he was using again. I knew it, you know. There's no way that he could behave like that and not be, you know. But I wanted to believe. I wanted to believe that I was the one who was crazy, that I was the one who had been causing this trouble, you know, because that's the way he behaved, just like the big book describes, you know, the alcoholic is like a tornado roaring its way through the lives of others, you know. And he pops up out of the cyclone cellar and says, "What's wrong with you guys? Everything's fine. Everything's fine here." And then I learned this week actually that he'd been having an affair with a grand sponsee of mine, and this had been going on for quite some time. And I have to say, the reason that I tell this story is not because I want you to feel sorry for me or anything like that. It's because I feel overwhelmed by the love and support of people in this program. I feel overwhelmed by a sense of a higher power working in my life. That it became clear to me very quickly that God had revealed this information to me for a reason, and that the trail breadcrumbs had always been there. I just became so sick with this person that I could not see it. I couldn't allow myself to see it, you know. And so, in times of trouble, which are sure to come in this life, you know, many trials and tribulations that come in this life, what I do is I turn towards AA, you know. When I've witnessed it, I've been a witness to it in the lives of others, in the hundreds of people who have come through my home group and not stayed sober, that when I turn away from AA, I drink, you know. And I desperately do not want to be the harbinger of that kind of pain in other people's lives, you know. That my grand sponsor, Sharon, talks about that, you know, like being the light, you know. And so that's what I've been praying for every day for months. I've just been asking God to make me a beacon and a safe harbor, to just make me emanate with whatever it is, that whatever light he has to give me, so that I can give it away, because that's all I got. That's all I got. All I got is this experience, you know. And I got 1 minute. So a quick story, very quick story. While all of this was happening in Ireland, The women that I used to sponsor, I still sponsor a couple of them, but women that I used to sponsor there, all got together with their pigeons, as we call them where I come from, pigeons, sponsees. They were sponsoring women now, and some of those women were sponsoring women, and they all came together. I was asked to share share my experience at my old home group on the 8th step, ironically, but they all came, you know, and so did many more people. Dozens of other people kind of came out of the woodwork to be there at that meeting to see me, you know. And I don't say that to, like, pad my own ego or anything like that, but literally all hell was breaking loose in my life that day, you know. And I did what I was taught to do here. You do what you said you were going to do when you said you were going to do it. You suit up and show up and be prepared. And that's what I did. I was ready to leave this meeting on the 8th step and just leave all that stuff out there, you know. And these people came into the room, and I wanted to share this because I went to a conference where I met Randy, actually, in October, and Sharon was talking about how rare it is that we get to see the effects of our influence on other people. That it's like a ripple hitting the shore. You know, we send out these ripples, and it's how rare it is that we get to see it hit the shore. You know, and there I was in this meeting, and everybody was sharing about these little things, these little small acts of kindness or compassion that I had showed in their lives, and how that had affected them, and then how it had affected the people that they now sponsored. And so I feel like I got to get just the smallest little glimpse of that ripple hitting the shore, you know. And the reason that I share that is because that has nothing to do with me. That has to do with the principles of this program. That has to do with suiting up and showing up, even in the face of, like, your darkest, worst nightmares, and just living the principles of the program, you know. And you guys taught me that, you know. Against my better judgment, you know, taking actions I did not believe were going to work in my life. And today I get to have these amazing experiences. It's not categorized by all the stuff that I have. It's characterized by you, you know, by the people that are in my life and the experiences and, like, the you know, that we get to share the spirit together, you know. And so I know this is said a lot, but I am so grateful today to be sober and to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. So thank you so much, Billy, for asking me to come and speak tonight.